Okay, here's the outline that we're using. Again, that's on page 4 of your notebooks. We keep referring you back to that to constantly keep in mind the setting for the book. And we're developing this last point here. And that gets us to the new material on page 20, this section that's labeled Working Honorably. This is verses 10 through 12 of chapter 9 is where we are starting this morning. So to sort of review what we were doing last week, verses 1 through 9 of chapter 9, well, actually verse 16 of chapter 8 through verse 9 of chapter 9, this section is getting us to again see that even though the world is uncertain around us and not everything always goes according to plan as we would think that it would need to, we still can do what we need to do, still serve God in the ways that He has taught us and directed us. And again, that phrase in the black box on page 19, the uncertain world or the uncertainty of the world should still not prevent us from doing the things that we're labeling here in each section. So we concluded last week that the uncertain world should not keep us from enjoying the blessings of life. That's down through verse 9 of chapter 9. One cannot look at the ways of the way things happen in the world and come to a conclusion, well, God approves of that or God disapproves of that. Things happen that are beyond our control. Things happen through people's choices. And they do not necessarily indicate, now they could indicate, but not necessarily indicate, that would be a situation that God says yes to or a situation that God would say no to. And that's some of the things that we talked about last week. We also noticed that through verses 7 through 9, we are still to be happy. You notice His words there. Go then, eat your bread in happiness, drink your wine with a cheerful heart, for God has already approved your works. Let your clothes be white, let not oil be lacking on your head, and then enjoy your relationship with the wife of your youth, the one whom you have loved all the days of your life. So all these things we're still to enjoy, even though life is uncertain. That's where we got to at the end of class last time. Now, we start the next section, verses 10 through 12. Here's something else that an uncertain world should not keep us from doing, and that is working honorably, having a good work ethic. And that's definitely needed in our culture. The next three verses of Ecclesiastes 9. Whatever your hand finds to do, verily do it with all your might, for there is no activity or planning or wisdom in Sheol where you are going. I again saw under the sun that the race is not to the swift, and the battle is not to the warriors, and neither is bread to the wise, nor wealth to the discerning, nor favor to men of ability, for time and chance overtake them all. Moreover, man does not know his time, like fish caught in a treacherous net, and birds trapped in a snare, so the sons of men are ensnared at an evil time when it suddenly falls on them. There's some things in here just from a practical nature that Solomon is talking about. So look at the first part of question 8, and this gets us to the first part of verse 10. What kind of work ethic is Solomon encouraging when he says what he says there in the first part of verse 10? All right, you work with all your might. Now, it doesn't matter what work you're doing. Of course, obviously we're assuming it would be labor that God would approve of. He's not telling you to engage in things that go against His word, obviously. But whatever honorable work one finds, and the world offers just a multitude of choices, what kind of worker ought you to be? Good worker. Dependable. Those are good words. Secondarily, because that would be what your employer would expect, correct? I mean, you're coming there so many hours a week. You've agreed to so much work for so much pay. All those things are ironed out when you agree to work somewhere, but that's not really why we work that way. What's our main motivation for working that way? It's what God tells us to do. We are that kind of worker. And perhaps you've been placed in a situation, it's happened to me in the past when I worked secularly, and I know some of y'all have maybe had some of the same experiences as well. Maybe you've been asked by somebody on the job, you know, why are you always sort of that way? And what's the answer to give? Well, because I want to be a good worker for the company. Well, that would be a true thing to say, but that's not the best answer. Because I'm serving the Lord, and He instructs me to work this way. In fact, I'm not just serving my employer, I'm really serving my Father. Look at the text there in question 8. Turn to Colossians chapter 3 and look at a similar passage that Paul wrote. It sounds a lot like what Solomon says here. Colossians 3rd chapter. Ralph, when you have that, read for us, please, verses 23 and 24 of Colossians 3. All right, look, starting in verse 22, let's make sure we understand the context. He's talking to slaves or servants. So this was the culture of the first century. This is not really talking about employers and employees like we would be using the text. But it was servants who were owned. They were property. And sometimes what kind of master would they have? Well, not a good one. And so if you don't have a good master, what might be the inclination of the slave who was continually mistreated? Run away or not do a good job? I mean, he's going to treat me like a dog. I'm not going to work for him very well. And yet, what is Paul saying? Yeah, he's not your real master. That's right. You serve a higher master. And so you need to do good despite how you're treated. You do good because of the statement there. In the last statement of verse 24, it is the Lord Christ, or you serve the Lord Christ. That's your real master. So Solomon, and of course we're not surprised by this, Solomon and Paul agree. The Holy Spirit, of course, inspired both statements. So, yes, the fear of God motivates everything that we do, especially, Freddie, you're correct. Colossians 3:22, it's our fear of God that drives us in this. So we need such a work ethic now. Back to Ecclesiastes 9, look at the last part of verse 10. Why do we need to be the right kind of worker now? What's Solomon say? What's going to eventually come? Death will come, which means there'll be a time when you won't be able to work anymore. While you've got breath in your body now and the ability and the opportunity to do that, we need to be the right kind of worker because there's going to come a time, he says, there is no activity or planning or wisdom in Sheol. That's, of course, referencing the realm of the dead, where you are going. And how many references have we already had in the book previously where Solomon says that it's the same for the righteous and for the wicked, that we all go to the grave? And he has said that multiple times in our studies. So this is what awaits all men. I want you to look at John chapter 9 and verse 4. We've read verses 1 through 3. Previously. And in that's the occasion where, you remember, the disciples with Jesus, they come across that man that was born blind. And you recall they ask him the question, well, who was it that sinned? Was it this man or his parents that this person is blind? Jesus' answer, verse 3, neither this man nor his parents sinned, but that the works of God should be revealed in him. But we're looking at verse 4. What did Jesus say? I must work the works of him who sent me while it is day. Then what did he say? The night cometh when no man works. Now, Jesus wasn't talking about, I don't think, his own death. Maybe he was in a general sort of way, but not specifically. But we could take that statement and apply it to all men. We need to work while it's day, while we have the opportunity. Why? Because the time's coming, night's coming, when no man can work. And we need to be prepared for that. So, what kind of worker are you? And this isn't just for adults. Let me hammer on the young people just for a moment, because they're here. What's your job right now? You're not earning any pay, but you have a job. What is it? You're a student. So what kind of student ought you to be in school? Same principle applies there. You do your work honorably, nobly. Do it with the right attitude, with the right ethic. And you're fulfilling the thrust of this passage as if you were on the job somewhere getting a paycheck. Now, some of your parents are smiling because I know they probably gave you that lecture in the past. You know, you do the right kind of, and I've given that lecture to my children. That's your job, and so you need to have that kind of an attitude, that kind of a mindset. And it's nothing that adults don't need to do themselves as well. We are under the same rule of thumb, if you will. So, life takes on a certain kind of a joy, doesn't it, when you accomplish something worthwhile. Students in school, and let's say they get a really, really high GPA for a semester or for the year. Now, how does that make you feel? And you really had to work hard to earn those good grades. Study hard, do good on tests, projects, papers, whatever it is. See, even this applies to people of all ages. And adults, if we're anything like we ought to be, if we work this way, then when the job is done, typically speaking, how will we feel? We'll have a sense of satisfaction about that kind of labor. And I think that's some of the things that he's talking about here in this text. So this joy, yes, the world's uncertain, and that's being stressed in the last section of the book, I believe. The world is uncertain. Nothing can be determined just by observing what happens. But even in an uncertain world, we can still operate on a level that brings some degree of certainty because God has set forth certain principles, one of which, whatever your hand finds to do, whatever it is that you choose to do with your life, do it with all your might. Do it with all that's in you because you know that's the kind of person that God wants you to be. This still won't bring certainty. We don't work this way to bring certainty to an uncertain world. That's not our concern. And look in verses 11 and 12. He gives us reasons why the best kind of worker still won't solve all the riddles that are out there. Look at the things he mentions in verse 11. I again saw under the sun. What things did he notice? What things did he observe? Okay, the race is not always won by the fastest person. Remember the fable of the tortoise and the hare? I mean, that came to my mind when I read that verse. Or the battle is not always to the strongest. Does the strongest man always win? No. Got a Bible example of that? David and Goliath. I mean, just on paper, Goliath should have just crushed David like a bug. Just looking at the size of both of them. But other factors are at work. And bread is not always to the wise, nor wealth to the discerning. The wise doesn't always come out on top. And that's because there are factors beyond the control of the fastest man, the wisest man, the strongest man, that are in this uncertain world that he cannot determine. The choices of other people. God's at work in the world, but who else is at work in the world? Satan's at work. He's going to have a say about how some of these things come out. Of course, all those are under the direction of God, but God does give him room to operate, if you will. And we know that from the story of Job in the Scripture. So what we're saying by all this is that even though life is uncertain, we're still encouraged to be the right kind of worker because these things certainly come into play, and we need to take that into consideration. So to sort of complete this thought, man doesn't know what awaits him. Look at verse 12. Moreover, man does not know his time. And then look at the way Solomon sort of poetically describes this. What does he liken us to in verse 12? We're a fish caught in a net. Or, well, what else? Birds trapped in a snare. Now, birds and fish are unreasoning creatures, right? They don't know to get out of the rain. It's an old expression. So they're caught in a trap, in a snare, unknowingly. It just is sprung upon them. That's how you... Freddy's a fisherman. He knows how to fool those fish. And birds ensnared in one way or another. What is the point being made here in verse 12 about the fish and the birds? What's the point he's trying to make to us? Yes, man can be snared. So What do you think he's talking about when he's discussing man being snared? What's the point being made? Well, what comes suddenly upon us? It's death. He's talking about our end. That's correct. And I don't think he's just talking about death. I think he's maybe even talking somewhat about a tragic death, misfortune, an accident. I mean, is it guaranteed that all of us are going to live a long, healthy life and then we'll die of old age? And the answer is absolutely not. In fact, tragically, who dies? Even the young die. Even through events that they don't bring upon themselves, it's just an accident. They get killed in car wrecks. They get run over. They get they're the victims of some violent crime. I mean, the list goes on and on. We know, and that's the world we live in. So he's saying, okay, you be the right kind of worker, but being the right kind of worker doesn't guarantee that you'll have certainty in life, because again, the statement's there in verse 11. The wisest, the fastest, the richest, the strongest doesn't always come out on top. We all have Sheol ahead of us or awaiting us, and you really don't know what's around the corner. Accidents can happen because the world is uncertain. So this is something that we all need to take stock of. But that is true. All of us are only one heartbeat away from eternity anyway. Just one heartbeat. And that's the end of our life here. So, while the text is talking about activity on the earth, he still includes in here, if you will, looking at the fact that you need to be somewhat prepared, because even death is certain, yes, but accidents can happen in this world that oftentimes has no rhyme or reason to it. And we need to be prepared for that. So, the uncertain world should not keep us from working, as it says there, honorably, having the right kind of ethic, work ethic. And to sort of close this out, this is another reason why these are the passages listed there in question 9. Turn to Psalm 118 and verse 8. And then also 1 Corinthians chapter 2, verses 4 through 5. This is another reason why we should always put our trust not in ourselves, or any other man, but of course put our trust, our confidence in God. That's Psalm 118, and I think it's the last part of the verse that we want. Well, no, it's the entire verse. It is better to trust in the Lord than to do what? Put confidence in man. Any man. Even yourself. And then 1 Corinthians chapter 2, verses 4 and 5, Paul was talking about his efforts when he came to Corinth and his preaching. Worldly wisdom versus divine wisdom. And he'd been talking about how, at the latter part of chapter 1, how God has used the foolishness of the gospel being preached to set at naught the wisdom of men. And so then comes in chapter 2, and Paul starts describing how he came to them. Now he came to Corinth. Verse 3, I was with you in weakness and in fear and in much trembling. What about Paul's preaching? Well, verse 4, my speech and my preaching were not in persuasive words of human wisdom, but in demonstration of the Spirit and of power. And the whole reason why was in verse 5. What was it? What did Paul want? Yeah, don't put your faith in me or any other man, but that your faith may rest in the power of God, not in the stature of of even an inspired apostle. Paul was still just a man. And so this is why Solomon tells us that our faith needs not be in our own abilities, because even our own abilities can fail us. And even through no fault of our own, again, back to Ecclesiastes 9, verse 11, things happen that will dictate that the right person doesn't always win. That's just how life is sometimes. But even though that's the case, what kind of worker ought you still be all the time? One with the right ethic, who works honorably, nobly, because he serves God first and foremost. These are great, great rules for us to live by. All right, anything else through verse 12 of chapter 9? Anybody have a comment? Right. 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 In fact, what did Paul tell Onesimus to do? You got to go back. You've got to go back. Now, speculation is, why did he run away? Well, you know, was Philemon being mean to him? I don't think the Bible says. But whatever reason, he left. In fact, not to get too far off our track here, but you read the text of Philemon, and even Paul says perhaps it was for this reason that he ran away, to come into contact with someone who would teach him the gospel and convert him. But Paul says, now you've got to go back. I'm sending him back with this letter to you, that you receive him back, not just as a slave, but as a brother, and that you'll treat him well. So that's a good point to bring up. No, there's none in the letter. You're right, Ralph. So that was to be left that way. Okay, page 21 now. And we're going to complete chapter 9, which is verses 13 through 18. Here's another example of living, even though we live in an uncertain world, that does not mean we should still not do something else. And this time, Solomon seems to be focusing on, don't let the uncertain world keep you from appreciating wisdom. How often has he been touting wisdom in the book up to this point? Well, I've lost count. I mean, that's been one of his major themes. So, chapter 9, verses 13 through 18 now, we should still appreciate wisdom. All right. Shirley, if you'll read for us, please, Ecclesiastes 9, 13 through the end of the chapter, please. Thank you. All right. Solomon says in verse 13, he came to see wisdom, and he says, this is something impressed me. He's going to relate an incident to us, and it made an impression upon Saul. Solomon, not Saul. So how does he praise the worth of wisdom in verses 13 through the first half of verse 15? What does he record? All right, there's this city. Now, what's the city's dilemma? What's working against the city? All right. Here's the king. He's got a great army. What's he done to the city? Now, what is a siege? Just make sure we understand that. When a city is besieged, what does that mean? Nobody goes in, nobody goes out. They've got a chokehold on it. No supplies get in, no help comes. It's just a waiting game, isn't it? You're gonna starve the city out. Let them use up all their supplies, and then they're beat, they're whipped. So here's this city. A small city. Few men in it. All right. Great king comes, surrounds it, constructs large siege works against it. So if you stop right there in verse 14, how would you describe the chances of that city? Not zero, maybe not even that good. I mean, there's defeat is certain. But yet, what does he say he finds? In the city. Small city, few men in it. But there's a poor man and he's wise. They find this poor wise man. And what does he do? He delivers the city through his wisdom. Not through his ability. He's poor. But he's wise. So see, already we're seeing what's better? A physical ability, wealth, prestige, or wisdom? And it's wisdom. That's what's been stressed throughout the book. So here's this poor wise man. Despite the certain defeat of this city, he delivers the city. Now, if we stop right there, that gets us to the first half of verse 15. The city's been delivered. The king takes his army and leaves. He's not going to take the city. Well, conventional wisdom would say, how will this poor wise man be treated? Wouldn't he get a parade? I mean, he would get the honor of the king of the city. He would be touted and praised and loved and cherished. He'd be the hero. But yet, what does Solomon say? Yet, nobody remembered him. What kind of status does he return to? Remember now, see, he wasn't a rich man in the city. He was a poor man who had no wealth, who had no honor, if you will, among men, but he had wisdom, something that others did not have. So when the threat is gone, he helped remove the threat. When the threat is gone, where does he go? Back to what kind of status? Insignificant. Big deal. There's a rule, and we're going to show it on the slide here, and those of you who are old enough, you know this is so. He returns back to his insignificance because of his inferior status among men. What is one of the uncertain rules that the world operates under? Isn't it this? What have you done for me lately? That's true, isn't it? Somebody can do something really good today, unless his name is some world famous cajillionaire or athlete or politician or whatever. Well, that feat will pass, and then later, like, big deal. What have you done for me lately? That seems to be this man's plight. He goes back to his insignificant status, and he's not remembered anymore. In fact, my version says the poor man is despised. That's the end of verse 16. What does the New King James say? Same word. Poor man is despised. His wisdom is despised. The wisdom of the poor man is despised, and his words are not heeded. Well, his words were wanted when? When the threat was there, but when the threat's gone, then we don't care what you got to say. So we see how this rule truly operates in the world. Well, only when you need it. Spare tires only there when you. But if you, the four tires are up and running, you don't think much about it, and that's not wise. Okay. Well, look at verse 17, Solomon says. The words of the wise heard in quiet. I think that really means from the standpoint of whispering things that shouldn't be heard. It's just talking about quiet, calm counsel. There's value in that, isn't there? The words of the wise heard in quiet are better than what? The shouting of fools, or the shouting of a ruler among fools. Look at this contrast. What does a fool think? That if he talks loud enough and long enough, that people go and listen to him? Yes, I'm going to drown everybody else out. No, what's better? Solomon says, quiet, principle-based wisdom will outdo this every day of the week because of the content, not of the delivery method, if you will. Look at verse 18, first part of verse 18. Wisdom is better than what else? In fact, what did he just use to prove this? Brute force, weapons of war, he says. Wisdom is better than weapons of war. Why is that? Oh, well, that's good, Freddie. If you're smart enough, you don't have to fight the war. In the absence of war, there's peace. Well, how do you get peace? Accidentally? No, through wisdom. those deals are brokered, if you will, but helps us avoid conflict. And even if it comes from a poor man, isn't that better than trying to outfight the enemy? There'll be casualties. And so even in a carnal sense, carnal warfare, we can see that. So he says wisdom is better than weapons of war. But then he's going to have a caveat here, the last phrase of verse 18. Yet what's the warning? Okay, the last phrase of verse, in fact, it's the last phrase of the chapter. One sinner destroys much good. We sort of have some folksy, common, everyday phrases that say the same thing. What's that about, an apple in the barrel? isn't that true? Doesn't one bad apple ruin the whole bunch? Something that's decaying or rotten, if it's contacting other things like it, little leaven leavens the whole lump, using a phrase from the Scripture. One sinner destroys much good. Well, all the good counsel of wisdom can be quickly undone by one sinner. And let's think about this just for a minute. I thought about this when I was preparing my notes. Think about all the good that can take place, let's say, in one person's life. Solomon's been talking about a city here, but let's make it a little more personal. A person can spend his or her lifetime building character. And in fact, it takes a lifetime to build character, doesn't it? It can't be built overnight. There's a difference between character and reputation, isn't there? Those are not the same. And character is built over the long haul. And so one can meticulously go about his or her life, avoiding this, avoiding that, doing this, doing that, that's good, and avoiding the bad, and building this sterling character that will make him or her known and loved by the multitudes. And sometimes what happens toward the end of such a life? Sadly, what happens? A mistake is made. And what does that do? Doesn't it ruin all the years of that hard work that, again, I use the word meticulously, they carefully tried to build this honor and this reputation. And with one deed or the doing of one thing, it practically, for all intents and purposes, wipes out everything that was labor over all those years. I'll give you an example. And I know that you've heard this before. What? Well, okay, I wouldn't think about Tiger, but that's true. I mean, that's true. That's in the news now. But let's think on a spiritual level just for a moment. How many men have we known or have been known who were great servants of the Lord for not just years, but for decades? Whether they're elders, whether they're gospel preachers, or whether they're just a valuable brother in a local church somewhere. Let's talk about Brother Haley just for the moment. I think that's the prime example that I can think of. I never met Brother Haley. Never heard him preach. I've got some of his books. Through his writing, he's taught me a great deal. A great deal. But there are some brethren who knew him intimately, knew him for years and years and years. Among men, this may be wrong to go down this road, but just for our argument's sake, among men, would there have been more men respected more than he? I mean, among brethren. He had the respect of many, many Christians because of his knowledge, his scholarship, his faithfulness in his preaching. But sadly, what happened toward the end of his life? He adopted an approach that the honest student will have to say does not harmonize with the Scripture on a very, very important subject matter, that is the subject matter of marriage and divorce. Well, when you say, of course, he's dead now. He's in the hands of God. That's where he needs to be. And God will treat him fairly. So we're not trying to dig him up and beat him up again. I'm just saying, when you see, you think about Homer Haley now, what do you think first? Do you think about all his good writings on the prophets and the Revelation? He wrote a tremendous book on Job toward the end of his life that I really treasure in my library. It's a great, great book. I've used it several times. You think more about that or about the other, typically speaking? What's the first thought pops in your mind? It's his error, isn't it? So see, we can invest ourselves in so much good through the years, and then at the end, one sinner destroys much good. One slip up at the end can undo what took years to build. It can come unraveling just in a hurry, can't it? Ever build a house of cards before? I did that when I was a kid. I was bored one day. I built a house of cards. Well, it doesn't get built in a hurry. It takes great care. But then what can happen? One blow and it all comes down. So things get destroyed a whole lot quicker than they get built up. That's the lesson that we need reminding of, and our young people need to learn that lesson. This is why we tell our children, build good character, and it doesn't get built overnight. You have to work at it and work at it. And then it can be snuffed out just in a hurry with the wrong deed. So I think this is real, real wise what he's sharing with us here. Yes, sir. What verse? Verse 18? Yes. And that's true. That's true. The first verse of chapter 10, I see a new subject matter being discussed, but there is a connection between what he just got through saying and what he is getting ready to present here in verse 1. So let's make sure we understand a change of thought here. I'm putting all of chapter 10 together, verses 1 through 20. The uncertain world. Go ahead. Okay. Yes. Right. Yes. Right. Very good. All right. Ezekiel 18 is a good Bible commentary on the principles taught here toward the end of Ecclesiastes 9. Thank you, Ralph. All right. Now, the uncertain world we live in should not still keep us from shunning, avoiding that which is foolish. And I believe there are several examples of this same thought being made or being emphasized or illustrated in chapter 10. And we'll put them together in sections, if you will. And we'll first look at verses 1 through 7. And we'll do that this morning. Before we end our class. Okay. So Solomon begins with a proverb, chapter 10, verse 1. What is the proverb that he tells us at the beginning of this chapter? Yeah, fly in the ointment. This is probably where that phrase comes from the Bible. Yeah, that's probably so. Dead flies do what? Make a perfumer's oil stink, my version says. What does the King James say? Putrefies a perfumer's oil? All right. We don't have any problem understanding that. I don't think that's really above our heads to grasp that concept. So, as dead flies, let me read it this way. As dead flies make a perfumer's oil stink or putrefied, then what? What's the connection he makes? Last part of the verse. Okay, folly or foolishness is weightier than wisdom and honor. Now, how did he end chapter 9? The last phrase of verse 18. One sin can undo much good. That's what he's saying here. And I like to think of it this way, to sort of again reconnect the thought. One dead fly can ruin perfume or oil. And back in the days of the Bible, how valuable was perfume and oil? It was a sign of wealth and prestige. Now, we don't think of it that you know, you go to a store and buy a perfume for not very much, and it's like, you know, that's no real indication of, not really, no. But in the days of the Bible, it was. So if you get a dead fly in there, then pretty much that oil has been ruined. You can't use it for the purposes that you would want. Yes. Right. Right. That's right. That's very good. So even a little folly can ruin something that is valuable. And I think this again is just a restatement of the principle made from the last part of verse 18 in the previous chapter. Some things take great care to build and to create. Now, I have no insight into the work of a perfumist, if we can use that word. But I'm sure back in the days of the Bible, and that wasn't made just overnight. I mean, I'm sure a lot of care went into that. And I'm likening that to the effort to build a character that we've got through talking about. It doesn't happen easily. And so when all that work is done and the desired thing is created, what's still the caution? What's still the thing to take thought of? Even the littlest slip up, the smallest thing can undo all that great work and that great effort that was taken to build or create the thing that is wanted. So they can be ruined with the slightest and the smallest wrong. The dead fly in the vial or the flask of the oil ruins all that effort and all that labor. Now look at verse 2. This gets us to question 15. Toward what manner of life will foolishness direct a person? How does he phrase that in this verse? Verse 2. A wise man's heart directs him where? To the right. What about the fool? To the left. So the Bible takes the position, or teaches the position, that what side is good and what side is bad? The right is the place of honor, and the left is the place of dishonor. Wisdom leads you to the right, foolishness leads you to the left. Verse 3. How does the fool show himself? Yeah. How do you know a man is foolish? Just by looking at him? Remember, there are things in life that we cannot observe. I mean, we don't have insight into the heart. So all we can do is what? We judge fruit. We see actions, behavior. And so verse 3. Even something as simple as a man walking down the road. My version says, even when the fool walks along the road. There's nothing to walking down a road. It's talking about even life's most mundane little tasks or activities. Even then, what's the fool going to do? He's going to illustrate, or he's going to evidence his foolishness. He can't help but to show just how stupid he is by his actions. And why is that? Why will he show that? Because he's a fool. That's the way he lives. Will a fool act wise? Not hardly. Not unless he changes his heart first and repents and starts living in a better way. But as long as he thinks that way and acts that way, then he's gonna illustrate and evidence manifest that he is the fool. So the wise man's heart leads to the right, fool's heart leads him to the left. And all who see the fool doing anything observe him to be lacking in sense. My version, in fact, uses that phrase. Even when the fool walks along the road, his sense is lacking. And he demonstrates to everyone that he is a fool. Well, that's That's an old phrase that's been repeated many, many times through the years. So whether it's through one's actions or one's speech, you can tell the mental aptitude of one, whether he's walking to the right or he's walking to the left. And we all show ourselves to be wise or foolish either way. Now, look in verse 4. If the psalmist says, if the ruler's temper rises against you. Now, we've had discussion already. Stop here for a moment. Go back to chapter 8. And let's go back and pick that up again. We talked about the value of civil obedience back in chapter 8, Solomon told us. And he told us, look in verse 3 of chapter 8, do not be in a hurry to leave the king. Do not join in an evil matter. Now that would be, of course, against the king. Why were we told to do that? Because what can the king do? Yeah, he can cut your head off. He can do whatever he wants. So don't be in a hurry. Don't be in haste to revolt against the crown. The king has authority to do what he pleases, and you'll be in bad way. So back to this verse now. What if you have a ruler or a king? Do kings always act wisely? Do rulers always act wisely? They don't. Kings, governors, princes, presidents, mayors, whoever it is, whoever the civil ruler is, they don't always walk wisely. Well, what if we have a situation, maybe we have, and that's my phrase there, authoritative foolishness. The temper of a ruler is expressed in one way or another that shows that, well, that's not a smart thing to say or a smart thing to do. Well, if we're forced to contend with that, what does Solomon say? Verse 4, back in our chapter here. If the ruler's temper rises against you, what if you're the object of it? What's he saying? Yeah, my verse says, do not abandon your position. What does the King James say? All right, don't leave your post. Don't quit. Don't walk away. Say, well, now look, you're going to act that way. I quit. No. What if then you do that? Then again, back in chapter 8, how could the king interpret that? You're a rebel, and then where are you? Well, you could get your head cut off. You could be punished. So Solomon says, all right, don't abandon your position of principle. Yes, he's the ruler, and he may be ruling unwisely. He may be showing himself to be a fool, not a wise man, but a fool. But you still don't abandon your position, because why? The last phrase of verse 4. What does wisdom do? Or my version says composure. Wise composure, what does it do? Say that again. This fan is born. I can't. All right. It will lay offenses to rest. My version says it will allay or diminish, set at naught great offenses. Somebody's going to have to hold their peace and hold their tongue when someone else is acting foolish. Well, it won't be the fool to do that. It'll be the wise man. He knows that there's other ways to go about this rather than just responding in kind. So again, don't abandon your position. Again, back to chapter 8, verses 3 through 5, about revolting or rebelling against the king, king or the crown. Calmness always allays great offenses. Great offenses. It diminishes those. So we're taught the value of wise composure. And I thought about this. I'd put this in the question 10, 16 there. And we'll end class with this today. Turn to Matthew chapter 10. And let's read together verses 17 through 20. Now this is words that Jesus had for the disciples. All right? Matthew chapter 10, verse 17. Paul, if you have that, read for us 17 through 20, please. All right, Jesus is telling the disciples what was going to happen to them. He didn't say when, he just said it was going to happen. Yeah, there's going to come a point in time when you're out here doing my work, and you're going to be brought before authorities who are not going to be glad that you're doing what you're doing. You're going to be brought before them for punishment or for intimidation to be stopped. And what does he encourage them to do in verse 19? And see if you don't see what Solomon's saying here. Yeah, you don't become worked up over all this. In fact, don't even worry about what you're going to say. Now, this is to them, not to men of all ages. This is just to the apostles. What did he say? Don't worry, because why? You'll be given the words to say. He's talking about their times of being inspired, being led by the Holy Spirit. You'll be given the words to say. So isn't he encouraging a calmness here? Don't get worked up over it. You just be calm about that, and it'll all work out all right. Well, let's turn to Acts chapter 4. When this, if you want to think of that as a prophecy or a promise, when it came to fruition. Acts chapter 4, starting in verse 13. What happened in Acts chapter 3 that brought this incident to be? What did Peter and John do? Remember, they healed that lame man, didn't they? At the gate, beautiful. And that gave Peter the opportunity to preach the second gospel sermon. Seeing that miracle got people's attention, and he preached again. And then they bring this man who was healed before the council and the apostles as well. And now they're questioned. Verse 7. By what power or by what name have you done this? Done what? Healed this man. And you'll see Peter's response. Verse 10. Let it be known to you all and to all the people of Israel that by the name of Jesus Christ of Nazareth, whom you crucified, whom God raised from the dead, by him, this man, that is the lame man, this man stands here before you whole. And then we have the very familiar verse in verse 12, where Peter says, There is salvation in any other, for there is no other name under heaven given among men by which we must be saved. Now that's their response. And look how the council reacts, verse 13. Now verses 13 through 16. John, if you read those for us, please. Acts 4, 13 to 16. All right, what's the council's problem? They just studied it in verse 16. Yeah, how are we gonna wiggle out of this thing? I mean, here's the evidence. He's alive. We can't deny what's happened. But what did they notice about Peter and John? They were unlearned men. They were uneducated. They weren't. They hadn't gone to seminary. They hadn't been trained like this council of the Sanhedrin. They were fishermen. But why were these men so calm? Yeah, the phrase there, the last phrase of verse 13, what else did they know? These men had been where? They'd been with Jesus. And what did Jesus told them back in Matthew 10? Is that the right passage? Yeah. When you come before the men, you don't worry about this. So sometimes those who are in positions of authority, they act foolishly. What was the foolish order by the council here in this chapter and in chapter 5? The order was to do what? You stop this preaching, we're going to cut you off just like that. And it would be easy to get caught up in that moment, wouldn't it? And say, well, okay, we got to fight fire with fire. No. What did the apostles calmly say? We cannot help but speak the things which we have seen and heard. We must obey God rather than man. That's just how that is. So in this uncertain world, Solomon says, you know, there may be a time where you are forced to interact with, again, my phrase was authoritative foolishness. And men will show their hands whether they're wise or they're foolish. If that be the case, he says, don't abandon your position. Don't give up your wise composure. Even though the world is uncertain, we still can shun foolishness by sticking to the principles that guide us, even in everyday situations. Okay, our time is up. And recall, there will be no class next week. Or the next 2 weeks, the last Tuesday of this month and the first Tuesday of January, there are no classes. So we'll resume our studies 3 weeks from today. That is the, whatever that date is, the 12th, January the 12th, here in Ecclesiastes 9 at about verse 5. So thank you for your good comments and your participation today.